Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Six of Marianne Williamson's 10 published books have been New York Times bestsellers. Four have been number one. Her books include The Age of Miracles, Everyday Grace, A Woman's Worth, Illuminata, Healing the Soul of America, A Course in Weight Loss, The Gift of Change, and her newest, The Law of Divine Compensation on Work, Money, and Miracles. In 1989, she founded Project Angel Food, a Meals on Wheels program that serves homebound people with AIDS in the Los Angeles area and has been doing so since that time. Welcome again, Marianne.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. I referred in the introduction to your talks that I first started attending at least 20 years ago, I think in the mid to late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as I say, that's where I first saw you. How did that start, and when did you know that this was your path in life?
Well, I began talking about A Course in Miracles at a place called the Philosophical Research Society on Los Feliz.
Mm-hmm.
And it was completely serendipitous that just about the time when I started, because I began in October of 83, very shortly thereafter, AIDS just started bursting onto the scene. You know, in just a minute, all of a sudden people were dying of this disease and nobody knew exactly what it was, but we knew that if you had it, it was a definite death sentence, and the organized religions didn't have anything to say for a while. They had to work through their own ambivalence. Western medicine kept playing cards and coming up empty. It took a while. Thank God things have changed. But at that time, that's the level of crisis that AIDS represented. So gay men in Los Angeles began coming, many of them, to my career, to my lectures, because I was talking, as someone talking about The Course in Miracles, I was talking about a God who loves you no matter what, and that miracles happen. And so that combination is really how my lectures came out of the very small context of, you know, just people who had been studying serious metaphysics for the last few decades.
Okay, and I first ran into, I think, at Church of Religious Science in West Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
You moved there at some point?
Not the Church of Religious Science, but the Harmony Gold Building.
Oh, Harmony Gold Building, exactly.
Yeah.
You're
uh-huh.
right, a couple of blocks from
right.
that other site. Yeah.
Right.
And
then my first book came out, and we started Project Angel Food from those lectures, and
yeah.
yeah, that's how all that happened.
Yeah, and the lectures that you give Monday nights now at the Saban Theater
right.
in Beverly Hills—
Yes.
Still the same source, the same principles, and just something new each week.
Well, you know, I always say that The Course in Miracles talks about everything without talking about anything specifically. So whatever topic, The Course in Miracles says you think you have many different problems, but you really only have one. That is your separation from God or love or enlightenment, whatever words you want to use. So one week I might be talking about relationships, another week I might be talking about career, another relationship I might be talking about health. This week, obviously, I'm sure I will be talking about what happened in Newtown and the issues of spirituality and political and social transformation.
Very good. Now, you started out doing these talks in a small venue. It moves to a bigger venue. Nearly 30 years later, you're still offering your wisdom based on these principles. You've also written, though, four number one best-selling books. At what point did you realize you were a writer?
Well, my first book took 4 years to write. My agent used to call it A Course in Writing. And, you know, I think even though that, you know, that paragraph that's often misattributed to Nelson Mandela, the paragraph in A Return to Love that says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate, our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. That's just a paragraph from that book. So for the most part, I think for writers, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels this way, you feel in your first book like, yeah, maybe I wrote a decent sentence in there, or maybe I wrote a decent paragraph. And then after you've written enough books, you think, there's a pretty good chapter. You know? I actually wrote a pretty good page there. And then you hope there may be a chapter. So you like to think that your writing gets better as you move forward, but you know, that's just like anything else we do. We hope we improve as we go on.
Okay. I asked you last week, Marianne, but for those who weren't tuned in, how did the newest book, The Law of Divine Compensation, happened? Specifically, how was its writing influenced or intertwined with the financial crash and the recession?
Well, it absolutely was written in response to the financial recession. I was at a lecture one Monday night here in L.A., and practically all the questions were about it. I mean, we've all had our financial ups and downs, not all of us, but certainly I have, most people I know. And I really have noticed with this last recession, there has been a tension and a fear in the air that was more intense than I had ever seen before. People really fear in people's eyes. And so that's why I thought that would be the topic we should discuss in this conference call that we did, talking about how spiritual principles apply. And the aspect of the spiritual principle that seems to me particularly relevant here is an aspect of the universe that I just gave the name, the law of divine compensation. Basically, it is this. It is that not only is the universe self-organizing, but it's also self-correcting. In other words, the first sentence in the Course in Miracles is that there is no order of difficulty in miracles. It doesn't matter what the shape or the size, what the problem is in the universe. The universe automatically knows how to correct its problems. Whenever there is a lack or diminishment on the material plane, out of spiritual substance, there emerges an infinite number of possibilities with which to compensate for the material lack. And when you know that, you live in a different universe. When you know that, you're grounded emotionally and psychologically in a very different place. Your thoughts are different. Your personal energy is different. So what you attract from other people and situations is different. And the trajectories that unfold for you are different. When you know that that is a universal principle by which you are supported with what Martin Luther King used to call cosmic companionship.
Mm-hmm. So what if there's an equation there, it's if I heard you correctly, and that's why I'm repeating this, for a lack that shows up in the material world,
yeah,
resources are available in the spiritual world.
Correct. And what that translates into in a very practical way is that when you know that there are resources in the spiritual world, then you stand on them. You stand on that with conviction. That will make your energy different. It will make the way relationships unfold for you around other people different. You know, I was reading an article. This statistic has been quoted a lot. Quite a few, if not the majority, of Fortune 500 companies have been established during recessions. Now, these companies were not started by people who were just whining and moaning, ain't it awful? I'm a failure. My parents were right. I'll never amount to anything. They're not hiring. Even if they're hiring or even if they're investing, it won't be people my age and so forth. I mean, it's our consciousness with which we stand in the midst of limited circumstances that determines what will happen now and how quickly it will happen. And that's what this book is. This book is a guide to the psychological and emotional and spiritual factors that allow us to triumph even during times of, you know, material for, you know, recession and lack and diminishment and, you know, in a mortal sense, negative circumstances.
So the book's been out since July, am I correct?
November.
No, oh, only November. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think I found a reference or an excerpt in July, but so on. Mm-hmm. My guess is you've gotten some feedback on this. You've gotten some feedback from individuals who've actually put it to use. Since we're encouraging people to buy this book, read this book, or pick this book up, what are some of the experiences people have shared with you?
Oh, people have been very enthusiastic about this book, I'm very excited to say. Also, I want to remark on something that, let me go back a little bit. If you,
sure.
If you look at the Amazon.com customer reviews, that gives you an idea of the kinds of things people have been saying. You hear anecdotes about your books, you know. It really, you can tell when you have something, when you hit a pulse.
Yeah.
So I'm real excited about that in this book. But I want to mention one thing, Terrence. You know, some people will say, and I've seen this a lot in my career, people who have never heard me talk, have never read my books, but have opinions because they think they know. So some people will say, oh, this is so horrible. Are you saying that children in Africa are starving because they don't love enough? Because, you know, it's a basic in the book that miracles occur where love is present. And with every thought, we either invite breakthrough through the presence of love, or we deactivate the law of divine compensation and block the breakthrough and deflect the miracle with the anger and the rage and the lack of forgiveness and the closed heart in whatever form that occurs. So some people will say, well, wait a minute, are you saying that a child in Africa is starving because they don't love enough? Well, obviously I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that the problem is a lack of love in that we're not loving enough. So love is always the answer, and a lack of love is always the problem. And I think now, I'm sure you've been talking a lot today about what happened in Newtown, Massachusetts. I mean, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, you know, it's so interesting because now that this horrific tragedy has occurred, everybody's really remembering what matters.
Mm-hmm.
Really remembering that we're all together on this earth, and everybody's remembering to love one another and to pray for one another. We'll do this after a tragedy. But, you know, the only way we will ultimately eradicate a culture of violence that we have now is by proactively committing to a culture of peace. And that involves a whole new paradigm of social change, because it's external change, definitely. Gun control, issues of mental illness, issues of video games, issues of Hollywood and gratuitous violence, all those external things do matter. But equally, it has to do with some internal changes, you know, facing the rage in our own hearts, seeking to, you know, looking at the places inside us, particularly where we allow anybody in our midst to fall through the cracks. You know, this kid who did this thing in Newtown, he did not come from a disadvantaged community. We will learn a lot in the next few days about his background, but clearly he was... whatever the problems he had, and I'm sure there were people in his own family that tried to address them, one would think so. I think we're going to learn a lot. But for whatever reason, his suffering was left not adequately addressed. And so I think that this is a profound moment of kairos, as they say, mm-hmm. of change. And I think it's a sea change. There's something, and I'm interested to hear what you think about this, Terrence. Do you feel, because I do, that this one, you know, after Gabby Giffords, there was a sense of nothing's going to change. NRA will continue to do its thing. There's something about this one, the fact that we executed our babies.
Yes.
I feel something. There's a sea change. We're not going to – something's going to change this time. Do you feel that way?
Well, here's what I feel. It's that we had, if I'm like three within a very short time, right? Aurora,
right.
Colorado, then
right.
Oregon,
right.
then this one. And
right.
the fact that this was – children,
right.
multiple children, multiple times. I mean, so much you will hear people when they talk about any sort of negative, they will usually say, but the children did nothing to deserve this. You know, whether it's, you know, whether it's someone who's blaming, you know, single mothers on, you know, not taking care of themselves or something. But even they, you know, will say, but children are innocent. Children did nothing to deserve this. So I think, I mean, remember the one that happened in Norway a couple of years ago.
Exactly.
That was, again, children, but they were Norwegian children, you know. But I think this, you're right. And I would imagine the fact that we are so close to the holiday season.
Right.
To the season when children are paramount in a way, when
right.
family is paramount, when reflection is paramount,
right.
I think that I mean, I'm hopeful. When you say, do I think things will change? I think I would answer yes to, will the mood of the country, will the mood of the people, will, you know, will this strike a chord deeper or a chord warmer? I think yes. Will it have the power and the lasting power, let's say, to actually make a change in the status quo on some of these issues, especially the availability of rapid semi-automatic weapons, which means that someone who gets an impulse to kill might kill 20 instead of 2.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly the point. And he did use a Bushmaster.
Mm-hmm.
So this issue of semi-automatics, you know, if he had just had a handgun, I mean, it's bad enough when you have an obviously mentally deranged person even able to get hold of a handgun, but it was his mother's. We don't know what the situation was. But if he walks in, as he did, most of those children were shot multiple times.
That's right.
When you have, you know, it's like in China, somebody the same day stabbed 22 children, but there were no fatalities. So we can't get rid of psychotics. We can do a lot to ameliorate that as well. But we can never guarantee that there will not be psychotics. But we can go a lot further towards guaranteeing that psychotics will not get hold of guns, period. But definitely this issue that almost any person can get their hands on a semi-automatic, I think that this is the time for people to stand up, to not allow our motivation to wane. I saw that Dianne Feinstein is presenting a bill in the Senate. The assault weapon ban, the subject comes around again, but this time we must not get off it.
Yes, and that's Marianne Williamson. By the way, what people may not know or may have forgotten was that there was a ban on such weapons.
That's right.
And the Congress, in their infinite whatever, I believe it must have been a compromise to get it passed at all. I believe the first time such a ban was passed, it had 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came up for revote 10 years later, it didn't pass. And so we the country lived for those 10 years, you know, without ban on such weapons. We got along fine. No hunter was without the ability to go hunting. No,
right.
Et cetera, et cetera. And we, I think that the fact that it has been passed before, I think also will make it more likely that we can get it passed again.
Well, in 1994, when there was the huge shift in Congress, one of the reasons quite a few Democratic senators and congressmen went down into electoral defeat that year was because of their support of an assault of a ban on assault weapons.
Yeah, they had two things that time. They had raised taxes, which led to 8 years of boom, and they had banned semiotic weapons, and for that they lost in 94.
Well, and of course, we go back to the cancer underlying all the cancers, which is that as long as we have money, basically our elections turned into auctions rather than real elections, with moneyed interests able to just pull the strings for Democratic and Republican candidates, because everybody needs the money in these major corporate and other financial interests in order to get elected and stay elected, then forces like the NRA will continue to have the sway that they have. And that's why the American people have got to stand up. We've got to have publicly funded elections. We've got to have a constitutional amendment overriding Citizens United. Right now, a multi-billion dollar gun manufacturing industry hiding behind the Second Amendment is so controlling what happens in this country that it is literally to the risk of physical survival of our own children. We have, you know, let's remember, we have eight children in America die of gun violence every day, Terrence.
Well, I didn't realize that number.
Yeah, absolutely.
Eight children a day. So again, remember, these are the ones who are innocent. These are the ones who have done nothing to earn their to earn what happens to them in any way, and yet because of the mood in the country, because of the laws in the country, and I so agree with you, Marianne, because of the our fractured political system that is dominated by money, we face children face these this number. I mean, eight a day, that's just ridiculous, Marianne. That question that you brought up about when people say, well, are children to blame for their poverty or their malnutrition, or the way I've often heard it is when someone gets cancer, you know, are they going to think, oh, I must have not loved myself enough. It's my fault.
Right.
You sort of answered that one and you said it's not about blame. It's about love and forgiveness. Let me ask another question, which always occurs to me in this, which is, how does the divine law of compensation account for the outrageous greed that we see on Wall Street and in corporate boardrooms and executive suites, and the fact that so many of them get off scot-free?
Well, the fact that so many have gotten off scot-free is because of the corruption of the U.S. government, that we're not prosecuting these people. I mean, in Iceland, they prosecuted these people.
And it worked, exactly.
Well, that's the law of divine compensation. That was the point I wanted to make. The presence of justice is a spiritual force. And Iceland did the right thing. They did hold accountable the people who caused it. They did prosecute the people who were at fault in this. And it's and you're absolutely correct. It's economics. Economics, or it's just like any other mortal material reflection. It stems from what is occurring on the inside. So the fact that Iceland did hold accountable the people who are actually responsible, from a metaphysical perspective, is part of what has helped their economy renew itself. The fact that there is so often in the United States, and this is true politically too, it has to do with when Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, and I think he pardoned him out of serious compassion, you know, in his heart, but it wasn't good for the country. Justice is important. We have 2.4 million people in jail in the prison in the United States. That of itself, our mass incarceration issue, is horrific, larger than the incarceration rate in any other country. This is the 2.4 million as compared to the 300,000 in the 1970s. We have 500,000 of those are nonviolent drug offenders. We have people literally, in Eugene Jarecki's
The House We Live In.
He talked about the one man who sold just a little bit of crystal meth and was given a mandatory life sentence. I don't know if it was mandatory, but it was a life sentence. We have people who have sold some marijuana who are serving decades in prison. And then you have these people, hugely influential, hugely wealthy people, who knowingly did things that caused this financial crash, and they're not even being prosecuted.
Well, let me, you know, it's so funny. You are anticipating. It's like you're saying the things I was about to ask next, but my next thing I was going to say was, the hundreds of thousands of men and women who end up in prison for possessing drugs, yet HSBC Bank was found guilty of laundering huge amounts of drug money, and one gets arrested.
That's exactly right.
And so if you buy a small portion and get caught, you may end up in jail. But if you launder millions to keep the drug trade thriving, you're too big to prosecute.
Right. And that is, you know, these are very, very serious times. And they demand responses from very, very serious people. This is a very sobering moment in American history, whether it's, you know, banks or gun manufacturers or pharmaceutical companies or whatever. And this is not about personally demonizing anyone, but it is about recognizing that there are some very unjust and anti-democratic, by the way, social and economic forces that are abroad in the land. And I think every generation is a steward of the narrative of our country. And I think after things like what happened with the banks and Wall Street, after what happened with this horrific tragedy, I just hope Americans will start doing, you know, in personal, my work for the last 30 years, as you were mentioning, has to do with really being up close and personal with people when their lives are in crisis. And sometimes when our lives are in crisis, we have to look at some things that are painful to look at. But if we don't look at them, we cannot heal. And that's where this country is right now. We have some really painful things to look at that have to do with causal issues for some of our problems and ways that we're not dealing with some of the real problems in our midst. But I'm hopeful, Terrence. I don't mean like I'm not hopeful.
Exactly.
But sometimes it takes some real bottoming out in an individual's life. And I think every time we go through these problems in this country, we're getting closer and closer to, just like you and I were talking about with the gun thing. I think after this event in Newtown, I don't know. I think the NRA is going to have more problems on its hand than it has with any of the others.
Well, one of the other things we saw just recently was the Sandy disaster seemed to wake a lot of people up that had been blithely ignoring or denying climate change.
That they're both named Sandy? What's a Sandy? Nobody will be naming their baby Sandy.
Oh, you're right. Let me ask you a question, Marianne. Does the fact that there's evidence to support this law, that people who do the things you describe, people who do focus on love and forgiveness do get the results you describe, has that been tested, or is that just that we kind of know it or we assume it?
Well, you know, more and more these days, there's all this talk about scientific verification of things that spirituality and religious and philosophical voices have been saying literally for thousands of years. For instance, the most prestigious academic institutions in North America now have statistically verified that people who attend spiritual support groups live on average twice as long after the diagnosis of a life-challenging illness.
Wow.
They have now scientifically verified people who are prayed for get out of intensive care units faster and so forth. You know, there's this talk right now about this best-selling book by this Harvard neuroscientist who had a near-death experience, came back and said that he saw heaven. So one of the buzzes right now is all this scientific substantiation of what is previously unquantifiable.
Right, the whole field of positive psychology really is looking at a lot of these things.
And the brain waves of people when they're praying and when they're meditating. However, I want to say, as somebody who is interested in the field of spirituality and metaphysics, these traditions that have been around for thousands of years have not been waiting for verification by this little upstart thing called, you know, Western materialism and the scientific viewpoint that's been around for maybe a couple of hundred. So even that's stretching it. So if science is recognizing it, that's very nice. But you know, when, you know, people at AA meetings who are, you know, have hit the bottom and are on their knees saying, I can't stop drinking or I can't stop using and I need God's help, you know, aren't looking it up in the American Scientific Journal to see if this is true or not.
Right, exactly. Hey, Marianne Williamson's new book, The Law of Divine... Marianne?
Yep.
Thank you for your time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
And thank you for your
generosity. And keep up the good work.
Thank you for what you do. God bless you.
God bless you. Marianne Williamson's new book, The Law of Divine Compensation on Work, Money, and Miracles. Her site is marianne.com. Birth 2012 Los Angeles Gala takes place December 21st and 22nd at Agape in Culver City. Marianne Williamson, Deepak Chopra, Jack Canfield, Michael Beckwith, Lynn Twist, plus music and celebration. Tickets are limited. For tickets and info, go to birth2012la.com. We have three different levels of passes to that event. Call in at 818-985-5735 and ask for those. Ask for, can I get some of the passes to birth2012la.com? You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcasts, articles, and transcripts. And to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. You can sign up at both of those places for my podcast. You can have it delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up at my site or by emailing me at TEMcNally@mac.com, TEMcNally@mac.com, to get a weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background on the issues in an email. Thank you to Marianne Williamson.